the title that I chose for this presentation, and I should own up immediately and acknowledge that I chose the title so that I can be as critical of it as I want, I guess. There's something absurd and contradictory about it. The truth speaks in silence. And it's, as a statement to begin with, it's slightly paradoxical. But then to take that slightly paradoxical statement and use it as the title for a presentation is, I think, even more contradictory. I thought perhaps I could simply announce the title and then sit here quietly and let the truth speak for itself. I'm going to try to do something on two different levels, and I'm going to try this in a somewhat experimental vein. If you'd like, you can think of this session as a kind of thought experiment. I'm going to invite you to be my co-investigators and participate in the experiment. We're going to try the experiment on two levels and then see if they come together. So I want initially to say something about each of these two levels and then try to tie them together. The two levels are implied by the two major terms in the title, truth and silence. So let me begin by saying something about silence. Is there anybody here who's a school teacher? One teacher, two teachers. Is it your experience on the first day of school, first day that you go into class, the pupils or the students are not sure exactly where you stand, what your expectations are, what's, you know, allowed and what's not allowed in the classroom. And so usually, and this even happens in college, you know, they're sitting quietly. Now, I think most teachers, when they enter the classroom and the students are sitting there quietly, immediately take advantage of the situation, because it's not going to happen that often, right? It's going to make things clear right from the beginning, you see. Of course, it never does any good. In this class, we always sit as quietly as you do now. Well, what would happen, you suppose, if when you entered this quiet classroom, you simply sat down in front of the classroom and joined in the quiet? And supposing you tried to prolong this experience of silence, what would happen? Well, I've tried this. I will go into the first session of an introductory to philosophy class, and students are sitting there quite quietly, not sure just what philosophy is going to be all about, and I will sit there quietly. And I look at them, and they look out the window. I won't apparently be busy with anything. I'll just be quiet, just silent. Within a few minutes, you know, I notice that there's a kind of discomfort developing. Huh? People begin to steady their shoes. You ever notice that when people are a little bit unsure of themselves, their shoes become very interesting? Somebody else's shoes become interesting too. The story by J.G. Salinger, A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, you know. Have any of you read it?
Yeah.
You remember? Was it Seymour's riding up in the elevator and somebody's looking at his shoes? Brilliant. Well, then the talk begins, you see. There's something about silence that we just can't take, apparently. Something powerful about silence. Some psychotherapists have a technique that they practice, which they call the silent treatment. If they have trouble inducing a client to tell his or her story, the client is always being evasive or defensive, or something like that, not really getting to the point, the therapist will simply sit quietly and wait and listen. What happens? You see, well, the client usually is anxious to say something and to start telling the story rather than keep the silence. Or have you ever noticed when you're meeting a new person or when you are in a new situation and you're a little bit unsure of yourself and you want to protect yourself, you want to make sure that you appear capable or whatever you wish to appear, you usually start talking a lot more than you do in other situations, right? And listen to people. You can usually tell when this is happening because they're talking a bit faster, a bit more than they ordinarily do. Trying to protect themselves from the silence as though the silence might, you see, reveal something. When I was in high school, I had the opportunity to tour the Bell Telephone Laboratories in New Jersey. That's because I lived in New Jersey. And there they have in the laboratory building what's known as an anacoustic chamber. Have any of you heard of an anacoustic chamber? A couple of you. Let me describe it. I'll describe this particular one. I'm sure that others could be built in different ways. In the midst of a large building, there was a room which was mounted on some kinds of springs so that it was suspended independent of the room, some kind of spring shock absorber system. So that this chamber in the middle of the building is not going to broadcast or transmit the same kinds of sounds that you hear in the building, the rumbling of machines or people walking or whatever. When you enter this room, you enter, the room is, say, a cube about so high, and you enter at the middle level. And you walk onto something like chicken wire. And you notice when you get into the room that on each surface, on all six surfaces, on the walls and ceilings and the floor below, there is a kind of very absorbent material mounted in the shape of ice cream cones. So a bunch of ice cream cones of very absorbent material had been glued all over the wall and the ceiling and the floor and everything. And I think that they're shaped, maybe some of you are engineers and could help me out, but I think they're shaped like ice cream cones in order to get the maximum absorbing surface. And then it's very sound absorbent material. Well, what happens when you go into this room is that it is as empty of sound. It is as quiet as any place that, at least I had ever been, probably any of you have ever been. Because any little sound that's made is immediately absorbed. And there's no possibility for sound being bounced around because you speak straight ahead like this and it just goes and hits the sound absorbing ice cream cone wall. You see, it's gone. And so if you want to talk to somebody else in there, and if I wanted to talk to you, and I were to look straight ahead like this, I would talk and you wouldn't hear me. Well, what happens when you spend a few minutes listening to the sound of silence? Listening to the sound of silence. Well, you begin to hear yourself. When I was driving out here to come to Holden Village, I found myself being very attentive to the sounds that the car made, you know. I mean, I don't know if other people drive this way. I'm very nervous that I'm going to be in the middle of Wyoming and the engine is going to do something, you know. And I don't know how to fix it. And I don't know what good listening, but I hear it first. Well, you begin to listen to yourself in this way and you discover that you're a kind of machine that makes all sorts of odd noises. And I don't know what the physiological explanations are, but the sounds that I heard sounded to me as though I could hear blood rushing through these vessels up here, you know, and I could hear things sort of vibrating through my own skeleton and so on and so forth. And very, very odd. And that's all I heard. And then it became very loud. I could hardly stand it, you know. Get out of there. So, the first point, then, is that the silence, you know, perhaps really isn't silence, but silence is the absence of some sort of created, organized, imposed noise that we make. That when we are quiet and stop asserting ourselves, stop organizing, stop making certain kinds of sounds, we hear a lot that we often miss. Okay? That silence perhaps really isn't the absence of sound altogether. But what, at least in the way I'm thinking about silence, silence is becoming attentive to sounds which are often overwhelmed by our own talk, our own, you know, language, our own arrogant assertions of what is and what ought to be and so on. Our own assumptions about what's beautiful or true or correct. Now, I can illustrate the point of our own assumptions about what is beautiful and true and correct by referring to a field known as experimental music. Experimental music isn't any more music than it is theater or anything else, but it just happens to be called experimental music. One of the leading composers of experimental music is a man named John Cage. John Cage got the ideas for experimental music, he says, after having visited an anacoustic chamber and having an experience, something like I described to you. At any rate, what Cage has said is that somehow our act of trying to order sounds is fairly arbitrary, and that if we really want to discover what is good, true, beautiful, what we have to do is listen to the sounds as they present themselves, independent of our own assertive, organizing, constitutive activity. A composer in this tradition named Al Hansen has tried to illustrate this principle with a composition called Carbibby. Carbibby is for a small orchestra of 14 automobiles. They are lined up preferably in a place like an Acme parking lot or something where there's a fair amount of ordinary street noise. And the score stipulates that the player of each instrument, that is each automobile, goes through a certain sequence of honking the horn, turning on and off the windshield wipers, slamming the door, rolling the windows up and down, flipping the radio on and off, and other things like this. In other words, the kinds of things that you ordinarily do when you're driving your car around. Each player is told, do this at whatever rate of speed you want, and do it in whatever order you want. That's not stipulated, that's completely random, see? And then the 14 people are just doing this. And you get what we ordinarily would call a cacophony of sound. But the proponents of experimental music are suggesting we have to learn to listen to that sort of sound if we're going to discover anything about ourselves and our relationship to nature and what is given for us to learn. That it's simply arrogance to assume that we are the orderers of everything, that we, like a Beethoven or a Mozart, can order and therefore produce that which is beautiful. If we want to discover the truth and the beauty which is inherent in the universe, we have to listen to the universe as it presents itself and not as we seek to make it present itself. Okay, that's That's silence. That's the first ingredient in our experiment. You want to ask any questions about any of this or say anything about it? Yeah.
I was wondering about your illustration there in terms of this, which all of you have been operating.
Yeah.
And then you follow that with a statement that it's almost a necessity to listen to that which is inherent in nature. And I'm just raising the point that an automobile is not inherent in mm-hmm. nature.
Okay. What I meant there, or what at least the experimental music school would mean by that, is that there are a lot of sounds which we ordinarily pay no attention to. That they're the sounds of the activities of nature, considering nature as a dynamic interaction between the environment and man. And that some of the artifacts we have participate in this. Now, on some level, this happens randomly, spontaneously. And the car composition is admittedly a very contrived sort of thing, but it's only meant to illustrate this principle and not really, you know, be that arresting an experience in itself. Okay, but it's supposed to suggest that in randomly mixed sounds which come out of the ordinary interaction of man with his environment, there may be something that we ought to listen for and not assume that the only sounds we ought to listen to are those which are specifically ordered and organized and presented as though they were conveying the ideas of beauty or truth or the good or something like that.
Pursue that further, if I may.
Yeah, please.
I assume that somewhere along the line you're going to make a differentiation between that kind of interplay and with that which is by its inherent nature, and I'm using this in its real sense, part of nature, because we can take a hike up in the woods here, and the sounds we hear are pretty ordered sounds. At least they're ordered as we perceive them, simply because we're used to them. And I assume that what you're talking about is removing the kind of sounds that we've created in conjunction with that environment would somehow have a message for us, whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think that you raise a very good point. When we go out and walk in the woods, we indeed expect to hear certain things. We hear what we expect to hear. The story is told about, is it Roger Torrey Peterson, the great bird watcher, that he went to a bird watching competition someplace, and the idea was to see how many birds you could observe before breakfast on a given day, and a little card and check it off. And he, Roger Torrey Peterson, won, although he never got out of bed. He simply pushed up his window and listened. And but he knew what he was listening for. He knew what he was listening for, and thus he heard the calls of many birds. Well, whenever we ordinarily go and listen, we are listening for something. And I wouldn't need to limit this just to listening. I could say seeing or experiencing in the broadest sense. Whenever we go into a situation, we experience it in a way which reflects, at least to some extent, our expectations or what we're looking for or waiting for. Now, when we go hiking up to Heart Lake or something, I think all of us are looking and listening and hoping for certain things. And we may not, see and hear other things. And what I'm suggesting is that perhaps in order to come closer to the truth, we need to somehow learn to hear and experience that which we are not expecting, or that which is independent of our own ordering or constituting of our environment. But let me give a quite different illustration. And this illustration I mean in a lighthearted and humorous sense. But I think that it does make the illustration. For several years I lived with my wife and children in Copenhagen. And Katie's mother, my wife's mother, had grown up in one of these small towns in northern Minnesota, which had been settled by Swedes and pretty much stayed Swedish. She learned to speak Swedish before she learned to speak English, and had a real idea of Swedish ways and values and so on and so forth. But she had never been to Sweden. Never been to Sweden. And so since we were living in Copenhagen, she proposed that she would come over, and then together we would rent a car and drive her in Sweden. Well, the Sweden that she had in mind was the Sweden of the 19th century, a very pious and agrarian and romantic sort of place, and not very much like modern Sweden. And I was really, frankly, a little worried that in a way traveling to Sweden would be a disillusioning experience to her. But we went along with it, and we were driving around, and thing after thing, and well, she could speak Swedish, so she understood what people were saying, she understood what the newspapers were saying and so forth, were happening, and I just wondered, is this really hurting her or offending her or upsetting her? I couldn't really tell. Well, we were going to go to church on Sunday morning in a church where her father had been baptized, and we were staying in a town here, and the town where the church was here, but thanks to a certain kind of Swedish genius, the only roads, major roads, that went between here and here went down this way. The only ones on the map, at least. And so we were driving, and it became clear that we were going to be late. And I noticed that about every mile or so, there was a road that went straight over, straight and out. And I thought, well, sure, all we have to do is get on one of these roads and go over, and we'll get there much quicker. Well, let's do it and turn up the next road. Well, my mother-in-law became very nervous, for sure, that I had turned onto a road that was only going to get us lost, and we'd not only be late, but we'd miss it altogether. And she implored me to stop and ask directions. So we did. And we pulled up this farmhouse. Now, it was kind of a run-down place. It wasn't the really well-kept, freshly painted farmhouse of her imagination. We looked for the people. We went around behind the farmhouse, and there was the farmer and his wife, and they were out back. And this is about 9:30 Sunday morning, and they were really drunk. And they were slopping around in their bare feet in the mud. And they were laughing, and they were just having this kind of time, And we're dressed up to go to church, and we're asking, is this the road that will get us to the church? And my mother-in-law asked us in 19th century Swedish, and the people just laugh and laugh. And, then they start saying, who is she and where did she come from and so on and so forth. And, well, she can't understand this, or she won't let herself understand it, you see. And finally I spoke and got the message through. And we were on the right road, and we got back in the car, and we'd driven for a couple of minutes, and my mother-in-law said, isn't that amazing? What? Well, how industrious they are out there doing all of their chores before going to church. Well, you see, she wasn't listening. You know, there was that constituting of her experience, making the world that she wanted, being unwilling to let, you see, what I'm calling metaphorically the sound of silence speak and really hear the truth. Okay, let's go to the second level, to the question of truth. Speaking about truth, I suppose is the most arrogant thing that one can presume to speak about. Most philosophers in the 20th century now simply don't speak about truth anymore. They don't dare to speculate about that which they say is essentially unknowable. And I guess the notion that truth is in some sense unknowable is what underlies now what I'm going to say about truth. Let me begin by referring to a little joke that was made in one of the Bible studies this week. Perhaps it was yesterday. The joke belongs to Father Capon, and the context of the joke isn't important, but the joke was that Capon says, "I can always refute an epistemological skeptic." Now, this is one of those wonderful jokes that before you can possibly get it, you have to know a few things. So I'll tell you what an epistemological skeptic is. Epistemology is that branch of philosophy which is concerned with the theory of knowledge. What is it that you can know, and how do you know what you know? What is the validity of any kind of claim that I know X, you know? What validates that claim? For example, you say, "I know that the cat is on the mat." When you say that, you ordinarily mean, "I know that the cat is on the mat because I see the cat is on the mat. That's how I know it." So that's what validates it. Now, the skeptic is a person who raises all sorts of questions about anybody's claim to know anything. So when the person says, "I know that the cat is on the mat," the skeptic says, "Well, how do you know that?" He says, "Well, I see the cat on the mat." And the skeptic says, "Well, how do you know that your senses aren't deceiving you? Maybe you're dreaming," and so on and so forth, and all of these kinds of questions. Well, Capon says that he can always refute the epistemological skeptic because he simply leans over to one of these guys in a public situation and says, "Say, your fly is open." And immediately he gets up. Well, or looks. It's open enough. You know, what I want to say is that somehow, and I thought the joke was funny when I heard it. But, well, no, there are certain kinds of jokes that there are Norwegian jokes that very few people laugh at all. And then there's another kind of joke that you only get hours later, and this is perhaps one of those. But anyway, I thought the joke was funny. And even though I thought it was funny, it's wrong, and that's what I want to say. That it's not a reputation at all, because the skeptic is not one who says, "I know that knowledge is impossible." The skeptic is not one that says, you know, "I know that you can't know anything," or "I know that knowledge is impossible." The skeptic is one who keeps saying, "Gee, how is this possible?" The skeptic is one who's really overwhelmed with a sense of wonder. "Gosh, you know, tell me about it. Explain." And skeptics get their bad name because most people aren't able to give very good explanations, you see. And the skeptic, still wondering, asks more questions. Now, what I'm going to suggest is that the only way that one can begin to approach the truth is out of a spirit of a kind of epistemological skepticism, or this kind of wonder. I mean, really wondering, a combination of utter curiosity and complete awe. You know, amazing, how? Amazing, how? What does it mean? That, of course, may always include some doubt. I may always be doubting this. I'm amazed because, in part, I am doubting. Would you ever be amazed if you weren't, in some sense, doubting, right? I mean, if it were just ordinary, run-of-the-mill, business as usual, you wouldn't be amazed. Okay. Now, thus, this spirit of epistemological skepticism, or this wonder in both senses, amazement and curiosity, is perhaps the attitude which allows you to listen not just to that which you expect to find, not just that which you put there due to the categories of your own experience, see, but actually is the attitude of openness to all possibilities. Okay. Now, a well-known thinker in the history of thought, a German Lutheran philosopher of the 18th century, the Enlightenment, named Immanuel Kant, made an oft-quoted statement. His statement was this: we have found it necessary to limit reason in order to make room for faith. We found it necessary to limit reason in order to make room for faith. Now, what Kant did was suggest two things. Kant's arguments are very detailed, and I'm not going to make any effort to try to explain them. So if you have questions about how Kant got to these points, you better ask me afterwards, because I'm not going to try now. But 2 points. One, everything that we experience, the whole world of our experience, which means the whole world of scientific knowledge, what Kant calls the world of phenomena, all kinds of phenomena, I mean, tables, chairs, but also the world of speculation, dreams, and so on and so forth. That world is as it is because of the nature of human reason, and therefore is a construct of our reason. We constitute or make the world of our experience, and we have a kind of inner identity with it. It's merely an extension of ourselves. We're very curious when we think about this. Is there a whole world that we experience? Kant says, human nature, indeed, necessarily raises the question of what might be beyond the world of phenomenal experience. That world Kant calls the noumenal world, that which is behind the phenomena. What we necessarily, as humans, begin to wonder about are the three great metaphysical questions, the questions of God, freedom, and immortality. God, freedom, and immortality. Those are the three great questions that we always wonder about and which we cannot answer no matter how thoroughly we understand the phenomenal world of experience. And so the phenomenal world of experience demonstrates its own inadequacy. And so we begin to try to probe into the realm beyond it, into the realm of truth. Now, what happens if we try to think about God, freedom, and immortality in the same way that we think about why it is that if I pick up an apple and let go of it, it'll fall to the table, or something like that. Kant says we get involved in all sorts of contradictions and confusions. We simply can't do it. Kant develops what are known as logical antinomies. They work something like this. Consider the question of whether or not the world has a beginning in time, that is, whether or not the world was created. This is a question which relates both to freedom and to God. Supposing we wanted to discover that as a scientist, the answer. Kant says, well, we can think about it as hard as we want, and through reason, through logic, we can prove absolutely that the world had to have a beginning in time. And we can also prove with the same logic and with the same validity that the world could not have had a beginning in time. The world has to be eternal. That is, logic is capable about certain things of proving both A and not A. What does that mean? Well, it's got to mean, Kant says, that there are limits beyond which reason cannot go. And there you have to make room for faith. There you have to open yourself, you see, Kant says, to some sort of sign or some kind of signal that suggests what it is that may or may not be the case. But there's no way in which you can prove it. If you try to prove it, what you're doing is reducing it to the terms of the phenomenal world, and in reducing it to the terms of the phenomenal world, in the case of these metaphysical questions, God, freedom, and immortality, and all of the derived questions, you involve yourself in these logical contradictions, these logical antinomies. So Kant is suggesting that in order to, quote, know the truth, this is a funny kind of knowledge, you have to understand the sense in which you cannot know it. And thus you have to limit reason in order to be open to the possibilities in faith. I'm suggesting that that is something like listening to silence. Let me give another kind of illustration, and then I'll throw it open for some questions and discussion. If I were to ask you to describe God, I could give you as much time and, you know, as you wanted, and you could write essays as long as you wanted, you could use computers, or you could paint paintings, or you could write symphonies, or you could use any kind of form of human expression that you wanted. But your task is to describe God. Say what God is like. Adequately. Completely. You know? How many think you could do it? His rutabaga stories. Have any of you read the rutabaga stories? Yeah, aren't they wonderful? It poses a problem, just sort of a child's way of considering the same problem. He imagines that somewhere near Galesburg, Illinois, in the cornfields, there live what he calls corn fairies. And they're responsible for all sorts of things, wonderful things. Well, how do you know there are corn fairies there? How will you know them when you see them? And so Sandberg's problem is, well, how do you know corn fairies when you see them? Because, you know, if you call up the county agent and say, I think I have a problem with corn fairies, science isn't going to help you find them, right? Well, it's this sort of thing. Imagine that you wanted to now, instead of describing God, that you wanted to describe your house completely, adequately, so there would be nothing that you'd be missing. Could you do it? Could you do it? Well, you might start out with a complete inventory of everything that's in your house, a long statement describing the spatial relationships of every thing in your house, every dish, every newspaper, every mirror, every article of clothing, and so on. Describe it completely, and say where it is and what its spatial relationship is to everything else, and so on and so forth. And when you got done, you'd have a huge document. But would that completely describe your house? No. I mean, there's still possible sorts of questions. You might want to talk about the history of your house. Where is it that everything came from? You'd need to talk perhaps about the use things have been given. You might need to talk about the way in which the house would change under certain possible circumstances, some of which may have actually occurred, as when your basement was flooded, and others which perhaps never occurred because you live in Arizona and it's not ever been buried under snow. But if you were going to describe it completely and adequately, you would need to include all of those possibilities, and I submit that any attempt to describe it is going to be essentially inadequate. Because any description, when you get done, is going to point beyond itself to further possible states, and further descriptions are needed. Okay, well, when you try to describe God, you discover that you're talking about something which is utterly and absolutely inexhaustible. And there's no way that you can describe it. There's no way that you can comprehend it. There's no science of God. Language of science, language of logic, ordinary reason tells us something about this world, tells us something about ourselves, points to God, but points to God in ways that reflect what we see, what we understand, that is, reflect our own particular perspectives. Our perspectives as individuals, our perspectives as 20th century Americans, our perspectives as Christians, our perspectives as relatively affluent, and so on. But those are partial perspectives which are incomplete and inadequate. So, if we're going to understand God, and this I guess is my thesis, then we have to open ourselves in a way to listen to the sound of silence, or to listen to that which is independent of our particular expectations, our particular constructions, our particular abilities to reason and to think, and be open in the spirit of a kind of radical skeptic, which just is a spirit of utter wonder. Aristotle says all philosophy begins with wonder, and I think that that's true when you think of philosophy as the love of wisdom and the love of truth, and if that's right, then all religious experience must begin with wonder as well. Now, I was thinking about this in terms of some biblical figures, and I think that, reflecting on the ways in which the disciples didn't understand Jesus suggests sometimes that they were, you know, they had this kind of perspective, they wanted a scientific description that Jesus would never give. And sometimes I think it reflects, you know, this wonder. Yeah.
Okay, if you know that it's comfortable to learn in that way and see your ongoing experience with the world and its realities in that way, that's one thing. And you're comfortable in that. Some of us may or may not be. My concern in looking at that for a community, I guess, is why are we so generally so lazy and locking ourselves continually into not necessarily narrow, but well-defined perspectives that essentially define that. Mm-hmm. Could we do that?
Give an example.
Well, okay, just looking at the charts, we're here, I guess the past week people have been exploding myths about their assumptions of how the world really is in food production and who has what and what it costs to do things. And we have to do that. It's right there. You know, we can't read it in the press very often, but if we really thought, we could tell that if our purchasing power is decreasing, it must be that a small country's purchasing power is decreasing almost with a binomial expression and geometric progression worse than ours. So there it is. That hits us as Christian people really hard. But we've got guards up. It's safe not to let it hit us.
Yeah, I think that...
That's what I'm calling laziness, I guess.
Yeah, I think that this operates on different levels. I mean, I think that it is a fact that whenever we experience anything, we tend to put on some kinds of blinders, call them presuppositions. Even when you're men, but the point is that even when you're men of very good will, you know, committed to equal distribution of the world's resources, let's say, and not simply closing your eyes to the hungry people over there because you want to have more. Nevertheless, you're operating with some kind of systemic presuppositions about how it is that economics works, for example, or what the true status of the future of natural resources, fossil fuels, and so on and so forth. What I'm suggesting is that this listening requires a kind of stripping away of presuppositions, and that if it is that you want to understand what we're calling truth with a capital T, or understand the meaning of God in relationship to us, then we have to strip away all of these kinds of presuppositions. It may be that the best reason that we have, you know, which is not simply the handmaiden to any particular political or economic or social program, that even that contains presuppositions which limit our understanding and reduce it to something which is essentially self-serving. But I think that as an analogy, what you've raised is a perfect example of the same sort of phenomenon.
So again, my question is, why is it that people seem to be prone to not ask the questions, to not be the epistemological skeptic?
Yeah, Aristotle said two things. He said all philosophy begins in wonder. He also said all men by nature desire to know, and I guess that's where I would disagree. I mean, I think there is a sense in which what we want to do is more determined by our survival sense. Now, we want to care for this particular body, and we want to be comfortable, and we don't want to be endangering ourselves, and so on. It may not be laziness as much as fear.
It seems like the more that you learn, and the more knowledge and things that you obtain, like say just on world issues or problems of world hunger and things like that, the harder it is to be a calm person, or the harder it is almost to, the more you learn, you know, the more frustrated you get. And so I think a lot of people don't, you know, they don't wish to obtain that knowledge because of the peace that it doesn't bring. It doesn't bring peace to you.
Now, you could observe this with many of the leaders of the war protest movement, who, at least the most articulate, or some of the most articulate, and energetic in really sort of stripping away a lot of myths, the people who are willing, like Ellsberg, to, you know, say, look, our government is lying to us, and to, what's happened to these people? You know, I mean, they're just... Yeah, it's a very, very hard business, you know. And the answer that Christianity offers is what's called faith. If you don't have that, sort of to look at the world straight on like this is as scary as can be. So, now there's some laziness too. There is laziness involved. I don't want to rule that out. I mean, but I think that the reason it's such a global and long-term historical phenomenon has more to do with fear than simply laziness.
But are you saying then that the fact that we do at the farthest extreme have the faith as the only thing to fall back on, that that in a sense allows us the freedom to ask the questions about immediate things and gives us a base to do it from?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure whether I would want to use an expression like falling back on faith. You know, I don't want to give the impression that I'm suggesting that if you have a certain kind of faith, then, you know, everything suddenly becomes easy. I don't think things become easy because of that.
Well, hopefully.
But nevertheless, it does grant a certain kind of freedom. You know, I would agree with you about that. Yeah.
Hopefully, exploring your spirituality allows you to come to a sense of wholeness. And that sense of wholeness is a confidence giver and the fear illuminator that you seek.
Yeah.
You haven't said the word mystics or mysticism.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if by, in the terms of what you're speaking, that what we would consider religious mystics, actually all they're trying to do is to give some kind of reason or at least a description of their experience beyond that realm of reason that we're able to handle.
Yeah, well, mysticism means different things in different traditions to different people. In his book Varieties of Religious Experience, James, in the Varieties of Religious Experience were actually lectures, and so this was a lecture, devotes a lecture or chapter to mysticism and defines mysticism. If we follow James's notion of mysticism, then what I'm talking about would not be mysticism. Two of the characteristics that James says defines mysticism are, one, there's some kind of direct experience which the mystic claims to have, which is the experience in some adequate sense of God. The mystic claims to have an experience, a concrete experience. The mystic also claims, according to James, that this just happens, that it overwhelms him. Now, there's certain kinds of preparations that are allowed, but James's argument is that, you know, you could create these kinds of experiences through various means, through the use of drugs or something like that, and then have an experience which in content would be like a mystical experience, but that wouldn't count, James says, because obviously it's drug-induced. So he wants to then rule out any kind of systematic preparation for the experience, and two, it's got to be an experience. Okay? And in those two senses, what I'm talking about is not mysticism. In the third sense, though, it may come close to it, because a mystic claims that the content of his experience is ineffable, that it can't be spoken. And it seems to me that the truth is ineffable in some sense. I mean, we can only indicate it indirectly with signs and symbols, with works of art, with poetic expressions and so on. And mystics try to indicate something about their ineffable experience indirectly too. You know, the poems of a number of mystics. So in that sense, there's a similarity between the position I'm talking about and the position of mysticism. But the real difference is, I think that my position is one that's much more deliberate and systematic, and one which I claim is possible by all persons. Simply, we could talk about some of the techniques for learning how to strip away presuppositions, but that would be another topic. But I think there are learnable techniques for stripping away presuppositions and so on. Understanding thought in a way which is independent of my particular perspective and the particular expectations that I might have, sort of bracketing those things out. So that's why I didn't mention mysticism, although in some sense it's close to it. Yeah.
Could you just very briefly give a few of your methods of finding the silence?
Well, I think that the methods that I'm talking about, first of all, are not things that can be given in a cookbook kind of way. It has nothing to do with ways of breathing or sitting or you know. In other words, it's nothing like some of the meditative techniques that people talk about. Which is not to say that there's anything about those which may not be helpful. It's simply that that's a different kind of thing. It's a process of bracketing out assumptions and looking at experience simply as experience, as though it were nothing other than experience, reducing the experience from something which is concrete, involving myself and my life world, to a kind of idealized experience which could in principle be between any possible world and any possible knowing subject, but which is utterly independent of me being the subject or this world actually being in existence. So that one looks at experiences simply as they present themselves and not as objects of an anticipation or an intending. So if we take a simple example, supposing you're in an art gallery and the painting is by Rembrandt, one may look at that, or let me give a better example, because supposing you were to go to the Museum of Natural History in New York right now and see the exhibit on Ice Age art, art done in prehistorical times. Now, when you look at that, your first tendency is to look at it and say, gee, you know, they really have some idea of things. They really are very sophisticated and so on. Well, that's in a way to look at it through 20th century eyes in terms of our cultural expectations and so on. But if you could set all of those aside and disregard them, bracket them out, and look at the mark on the cave wall just as it presents itself for what it is, and not try to look at it because it has, you know, it foreshadows some sort of symbolic expression which has become later well known or something of that sort. Try to bracket out all of the different expectations that you have for something and just let it be there in its purity as it presents itself. So that's analogous maybe to this car bibby with the 14 cars. I mean, that's the name of the composition. The idea there in listening to that is not to say, gee, that's just a bunch of nonsense and noise and people honking their horns and turning on their windshield wipers for no reason at all. How stupid. And most people, when they go to concerts of experimental music, leave before it's over. And if they've paid money for the ticket, they leave angry. But the challenge of experimental music is to open yourself to it and not experience it in any frame of presuppositions, but to experience just as something utterly new.
How?
Well,
really?
Yeah. The in order to in order to
like going to the cave paintings in particular.
Yeah. In order to talk about this, I would need to talk about the techniques of phenomenological reduction that Husserl talked about. And I think that would be better for maybe you and I to talk about, not in a big context, because it gets really technical.
Usually I'm not in New York looking in a museum. I'm in Oregon doing dishes in my kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like to know how to do this in my own situation.
Okay, but the only reason for mentioning that example was because there you have something from so long ago which is suddenly brought into a modern context. And our first, I think, tendency is to think of it utterly in terms of its frame.
Isn't it unfortunate that they decided to exhibit this in a museum of natural history instead of, say, like at the Metropolitan Museum of Art? I think that one...
That's a very interesting... sense of the way in which this work has been regarded, yeah.
Because when we think about history, we think of conveying our order, we think of ourselves as in the position of a storyteller. We see not only the art, but we see what's preceded it, and what's come after it, and we convey our order on it. But when we look at it as art, to some extent, we look at it for its own sake. I don't know if it's of any help, but I've been thinking a little. There's a little Whitman poem that goes on. I think I will do nothing now but listen to a crew that I hear it to myself, to let sound contribute toward me. And I think what we tend to do is to contribute our order to the sound.
Say that poem again a little bit louder so everyone hears? Because I think I know that poem, and I just didn't. I couldn't cite it by memory, but it really makes the point that I wanted to make very well.
I think I will do nothing now but listen to accrue what I hear into myself, to let sound contribute toward me. But it is part of human arrogance to embroider the sound.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to resist so much rushing to closure. isn't it true, though, that most would lead to existential despair? I mean, as we perceive the silence and search in within ourselves for truth, the result is the theater of despair. And I think of an example. Can you cite me an example of hope that is found in the situation without the words?
Well, let me respond in two ways. First of all, I guess I'm persuaded enough by Kierkegaard to think that our condition as transient, finite, particular beings is always one of despair, and that despair takes many different forms, and sometimes we don't recognize the despair. We, out of, I think, fear, transmute despair into something else, but I think that our condition is one of despair. But then I don't think, secondly, that despair is without hope. One understands one's particular finite limit, and that the perception of one's own finitude and the perception of one's utter dependence on not oneself, but on God is essentially one of despair. But it's also, when one understands the promise of Christianity, one of hope. But now, these signs are simply not available to us through reason, or at least so Kierkegaard argues. If we were to try and understand reasonably Christ, we wouldn't get anywhere, you see. So we need to have a kind of openness. I mean, from the standpoint of reason, the idea that God, the eternal, should become man and time is offensive, contradictory, can't be. Christianity rests on the absolute paradox. Well, in order to have the hope, then, Kierkegaard argues, I think it's a good argument, one needs to somehow understand the essential limits of reason and one's essential dependence on God, and then in one's despair there is the hope of redemption.
But, yeah. When that thing, I understand more today than I did before. When Christ said, "I will not leave you comfortless, I will come to you," he was talking about a mystic experience.
Well, I think it's an experience which goes beyond reason, which has an ineffability. That, to that extent, if you want to call it mystic, I don't think it's mystic in the sense that James defined mysticism. I don't think one needs to be a mystic to have that kind of experience.
But I think there's one more step we can take beyond what we sometimes as Christians take. I mean, just in our silence to let God speak.
That's the whole point, according to me,
yeah,
at least.
That's what you're saying, but it just, as it was left without, it seemed to me a silence into despair.
Ah, yeah. See, I began by saying this was a kind of experiment or a kind of invitation. And after all, I mean, if you take this position seriously, then you can't ever preach dogmatically or authoritatively and say, "You listen and this is what you're going to find." See? Right? The whole point is, you listen. That's all.
I have a fear of not finding anything if I took away something.
Yeah, I know. It's scary.
I know. I mean, like, you sit there and you try not to, you know, put any expectations on what you're going to hear or on a lot of things, and then you, the minute you think you come up with nothing, I interrupt myself and go do something so that I don't.
Yeah. I think that's why the psalmist and then later Paul in his letter to the Philippians talks about fear and trembling. Work out your own salvation in fear and trembling. There is. It is scary.
Tell us about the principle of distraction. That distractive quality in I'm not a Kierkegaard scholar, but I remember reading Kierkegaard, and he said something like, "Our ability to be distracted is a good indication of how fearful, or that we do have a sense of the whole and the terror, and we constantly shying away from moving toward it and running away."
In the same mood, Pascal, before Kierkegaard, said something like this: "Most of man's difficulties come from his inability to be alone in a quiet room. We're always looking for distraction, unwilling to." See, the kinds of things I was saying at the beginning, I meant to suggest on the level of very common sorts of experiences, that we are, in a way, afraid of the truth, that there's something powerful and that we're looking for distraction. This is why for Kierkegaard, I mean, I don't want to turn in now to an exposition of Kierkegaard, but for the person who is caught up in the world of immediacy, immediate gratification, pleasure and pain and so on and so forth, despair takes the form of boredom. What you don't want, you see, is, and I always think about this when we hear of boredom. Boredom. So, you know,
boredom usually precedes change, doesn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes boredom becomes itself so unbearable that one is willing to completely abandon this life of immediacy. But more often, one simply runs from one pleasure to another pleasure or something in order to avoid boredom. But one always tries to avoid boredom, I think. Yeah. It's the point where a profound change happens, according to Kierkegaard, is when you realize that simply going from here to here doesn't essentially change things. I mean, you dispense with this particular boredom, but it doesn't change the condition of your experience.
But that, it's at that point then, isn't it? Or, well, I don't mean to say at that point, but that's a situation in which one can move from that sphere to real life,
mm-hmm.
by the bridge of faith,
mm-hmm.
that because of faith that really all things are kind of wait for the fullness of time. I think that the desire to affect history and everything that's happening around us sometimes results in this urgency, the sense of urgency that, but we want it right now, we want to do this immediately, like we want everyone who is hungry today to be fed today, and that sort of thing. But then I think the bridge of faith comes to our assistance there by, with its assurance that, you know, God indeed does not that sometimes things wait for the fullness of time.
Yeah, it's a funny kind of assurance, though. Kierkegaard would say it's not really a bridge. We don't have that kind of security. There's a chasm.
I thought he was the one that used the word bridge.
There's a chasm to get over.
Oh, all right. You get over the chasm by the bridge, maybe.
Yeah, no, Kierkegaard marveled that the Danes were always building bridges. Danes love bridges. Still love bridges. But what you really have to do is leap. You can't have the security of the bridge.
Oh.
And you're leaping into the unknown, see? You're not taking a bridge to where you know you're going. So the assurance is accompanied by a very profound sort of anxiety as well. The anxiety which discovers both freedom and dependence. You know, and you can't manage things yourself. Kierkegaard's point is.
I don't know if Scott was alluding to this earlier, but something about the problem of public knowledge versus the quietness or the despair that comes in quiet, or the truth seeking that comes in quiet. But, well, I'm sure all of us have experienced churches where there's such a flurry of activity and we want to, you know, throw up our hands and say, stop. But I think that there is always a contradiction between the comfort of living in a public space or being part of a public endeavor, the assurances, speech, the order we give to our public endeavors, and then that personal, very, very, very personal despair. I don't even know how it's reconciled in the Christian church. I think maybe I don't think I've really thought about it, but I think there's some real contradiction between participating in a Christian community and having Christian despair or religious despair. I don't think that they really lead into each other.
Yeah, two things. One, we're having a forum Wednesday night which will deal with precisely this question. The title is Loneliness, but what it really is getting at, I think, is what you're talking about. Secondly, I think that it's a real conflict. I mean, it may be that the churches are the busiest places in the world, in a way, in that busyness, get away from what they ought to truly be about. The question of whether or not Christian faith can be institutionalized in the forms that we ordinarily think of when we think of the church, I think is a very profound and difficult question, and one which I don't claim to have any kind of answer for. But
it's something that the church has got to address if it's intending to be an institution at this point, in lots of different ways, because people who in our fast culture are realizing that their survival instincts are more than paying attention to what the technological culture is telling them to do are also translating that into their looking at the church and how it's an extension of the culture, and saying, that, you know, go away.
Mm-hmm.
You're too strict. You're saying to me what my perception should be, and I don't have any experience. How do I get the experience? You're not showing me anything about how to do that.
This is what I was hearing said before, and it's a question for me, rather personal question, I guess. Now, how do you experience the silence? And I can't agree that all silence is despair. I really like the phrase, be still and know that I am God. I really love that. That's fantastic, you know. And I remembered this morning how much I wasn't still this week, and just let that experience of God soak into me. You know, I've been involved in some bustle and some reading and some listening and some talking. But I heard the question being said earlier, you know, how can we learn to be still and get into the silence so the truth is revealed. How can we do that? And I guess I have a frustration when I hear you talking about the reduction of phenomena, you know, which, okay, that's good, you know, we have to have a theoretical background to that, but is that going to satisfy the needs of somebody who is not into that stage of hypothesizing and theorizing? You know, do we need something that's practical? And I hear you saying, yeah, how do we do this kind of thing? I don't know.
Two things I was thinking of. One is you can see the goal of self-awareness and finding your own quiet to focus on your impressions of the truth. I mean, you can see that goal and you have to be really careful in our culture not to try to get there through some gimmick. You know, that's what I hear you say. Don't run right out and learn how to meditate or get in your jogging shoes, because that's not going to get you there. But those are practical things that might be helpful. The other thing I was going to say is just a small example about how not to assume, and that's the root of your listening, how to do away with predisposition and how not to assume. I practice law, and if I assume when I interview my clients by what kind of clothing they have on, whether or not they're crying, all the physical things they're throwing at me, if I assume something about their personality and use it in preparation of the case, I'm blown out of the water. Because until I've talked to them for 2 or 3 hours in really intense communication, I really know very little about them. Those are good indicators. Things that start me wanting to assume, but I have to be really careful. This is 8 months of deep experience talking here. But I have to really be careful not to assume what those people are like. That this person is a factory worker and came into my office with jeans and grubby hands doesn't mean that that person doesn't have a handle on what his or her problem really is. And that if I just listen, I don't even have to work at finding out the problem.
I wonder if that's the problem that you're talking about in the church, the point where I do experience despair, is the despair of not being able to share my own personal despairs with others. I've worked with the church for 8 years, and I yet find the church a very lonely place in many respects, because it's, you know, it's either here or here, but most of the time there. You know, and I'm really having a need to, you know, just to be able to share some experiences with some people. You know, and to talk about some of the despair that you were talking about, I think, and to also for me to minister to other people in a sense that I wouldn't normally do. And how can we explore this silence together? How can we understand each other together? How can we understand our Lord together? In some very meaningful ways, instead of a program, instead of an organized worship service on Sunday morning. How do we enter in each other's lives?
There's a way at which I've seen this sometimes played at. There's real temptation, you know, to say now we've got to get away from these sort of busy programs and rediscover ourselves and God. Still voice, and let's have a program to do that. And the congregation that I was part of for a while had a service every week, which was a service of silence. You know, I thought that was a marvelous idea. But what I observed happening after a while was that it became a kind of game, sort of outward vestment that people wore. And I know how to be silent better than you. And that kind of thing. And so I think that I think there's a terrible tension here and a very difficult question. I really do. And I refuse, because of what I think and believe about this, to tell you what the answer is, because I would be wrong. But there's something, I think there's a kind of loneliness and despair which is a part of this. And I think that the people learn to listen, using that metaphor to mean more than simply listen, but learn to listen in their own way. And that there may be, you know, it's clear that lots of people really want this, you know. I think the sale of jogging shoes attests to this. I mean, you've read about the experiments where the anti-jogging faction, you know, was so proud that they proved that pigs got heart attacks after they jogged on treadmills. But the most interesting thing was the response. You know, runners say, well, we don't run for that reason. We're running because it's a kind of experience. It's a time when we can be with ourselves and so on. Well, then you look at the New York Times bestsellers list, and in the top 10, about 6 of them are books like The Power of Running, which have to do with, you know, sort of this running to self-discovery. Gosh, how am I going to do it? You see the cartoon in The New Yorker, where a guy is sitting in front of television, and he's obviously got on the latest thing in jogging shoes, running shoes, whatever you call them. I bought these because they were on a throwaway table for $4. They had little tennis rackets on the back, but I was in that department, you know, and the salesman came up and said, well, this is the newest thing, and he brings out a pair of $45 glow-in-the-dark running shoes, you see, so you don't get run down at night, I guess. At any rate, he's sitting there with his shoes on, watching television, and he has a terrible look of anxiety on his face, and the shoes are speaking. Take me for a run. Well, the shoes didn't get him where he wanted to go. I guess that's a serious point to that. And
I guess what I'm saying, what are the tools for discovery? I'm not too sure there's an answer. I think it's the discovery.
I think there's something in each person which manifests itself in very individual ways, and that what you need to do is somehow let go and let be. Now, in the specific interpretation of phenomena, there are these kinds of techniques, which aren't techniques in the sense of meditative techniques. They're really sort of logical instructions for phenomenological reduction. But I think that the sort of thing you're talking about is on a different plane. One really doesn't need to become a phenomenological psychologist to listen. But I think that one does that in a way it's disconnecting, stepping away, paying attention to yourself. How do you do that? That depends so much on who you are and where you are and, you know, what drum you're listening to now. I don't think there can be a prescription for how to do that.
It seems like the minute a prescription evolves, well, then you're locked into, as you say, the same type of problems that your original program, like the church, to de-institutionalize the church, you know, is, well, it's really literally impossible as far as I can see, because what you have to replace it with is going to become a program of its own. And probably with all of the inherent problems, I think we all suffer the frustration with the institution of the church for some of the things that people have mentioned here today. But when you start, you know, start trying to figure out what you can replace some of these almost senseless programs or aspects of the institutional church, you can't really replace it with anything better, because it will in itself bring with it all of the problems of organization and program again.
But if you let the idea that a group has to have a program to interact, govern you, right, then you can redo everything and you won't have gotten anywhere. But if you take a new idea for the church and say it doesn't need a building, I'm just throwing one at you, okay? neither espousing it and not committing. Everybody that wants to be a Christian, wear a cross on your head. So we can go around the city and we can say, oh, hi. And if you end up in a restaurant with four of you, sit at the table and see what you have in common and talk about your personal search. The community of believers is an idea that is basically undefined in our culture, you know. We have a bunch of people that come from all sides of the city and flock down in this big building. What kind of a community is that?
Yeah, but there within the church, you know, we have an individual. I mean, the church is our people. And so when I come to worship in a place, even though, and I used to have a real hang up that we all came to, you know, a building, and that church was a building, but I come from now that when I go in there and I sit in there, the church are the people that are sitting next to me. So when I worship, I'm worshiping with them. I'm not worshiping, you know, because this building is here. I mean, I just think that the service, even though services become programmed, that we need to learn within ourselves how to make them new and how to, you know, how to get things out of them and how to interact with the people that are sitting next to us.
Yeah, well, whatever the merit of how you see worship or she does, my point was to forget that growth and new ideas are important is destructive in itself.
Yeah.
Well, it's time to express our survival needs.